As soon as the message came out about SNAP benefits, I think there was an immediate reaction and response of like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do in November?
Volunteer food banks step up to the plate as the government shutdown gets very real. This weekend marks a cutoff of food aid to millions of low-income Americans. What they're saying at the food pantry, what they're saying on Capitol Hill, and strong reaction from U.S. Catholic bishops to the real needs of real people. The Apostolic Nuncio to the United States joins us in studio to discuss Pope Leo's enthusiasm for his upcoming November encounter with American teenagers.
She should marry me.
And we talk to the actor who plays the lead role of King David in the smash hit House of David. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
For a lot of people in this building, this is sort of a game, you know. It's like, oh, who's ahead, who's behind, as if it's a horse race. It's not a horse race. 42 million people are about to go without food, including a lot of children.
Republican Senator Josh Hawley, Missouri, criticizes his own Capitol Hill colleagues and raises alarm bells about federal food aid running out this weekend for millions of low-income Americans. In a deadlocked Congress, Hawley introduced a bill with bipartisan support to fund SNAP food stamp benefits amid the shutdown. But the bill will not advance because Republican leadership wants Democrats to first vote to open the government and end the shutdown. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. The government shutdown now enters its second full month with no end in sight and no action on Capitol Hill or the White House to work across the aisle to negotiate its end. Democrats and Republicans blame each other. The damage is mounting and the impact is becoming more apparent. This weekend, for the first time since the food stamp program became permanent in 1964, government funding for critical food assistance will be interrupted. 42 million low-income Americans depend on SNAP or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program to eat.
On Saturday, this gets very real. SNAP benefits will stop flowing to all those who need it. You're talking about tens of millions of Americans at risk of going hungry.
Hungry Americans are not poker chips. Their health and well-being are not to be gambled with.
That's House Speaker Mike Johnson, whose own congressional district in Louisiana has one of the highest percentages of SNAP recipients of any congressional district in the U.S., at almost one out of every five people. And Representative Angie Craig, the senior Democrat on the House Agriculture Committee, who said the Trump administration has chosen not to tap into a $5 billion SNAP contingency fund designed to keep benefits flowing in an emergency. Earlier this week, 25 states, led by Democratic attorneys general, sued the Agriculture Department, saying it is legally obligated to utilize those funds. The Attorney General of North Carolina talks about the number of people who will be affected in his state.
Food pantries, churches, and nonprofits do great work, but they cannot scale up to meet the need of 600,000 kids who will not have enough to eat starting next week. This is the deliberate precipitation of a major hunger crisis. It's unlawful. We're going to do everything we can to fight it.
Well, we have to deal the cards that we're dealt. And they're frozen in Washington right now, so we're doing it ourselves, unfortunately.
And that is Governor Henry McMaster of South Carolina, who, along with leaders of many other states, say they will dip into state coffers to temporarily fill the need caused by the frozen food stamp program. Some states will provide direct assistance to recipients. Others are instead donating money to food banks and partner organizations. That attorney's general lawsuit to force the government to distribute money in the USDA SNAP contingency fund was heard in federal court on Thursday. That judge in Massachusetts ruled on Friday, as did a second federal judge in Rhode Island, ordering the Trump administration to pay for food stamps during the shutdown. The courts said the USDA emergency funds must be distributed and paid as soon as possible and ordered an update from the government by Monday. But monies in the fund are not enough to cover the entire month of November, and it is not clear how quickly the money, if the Trump administration agrees to release it, will actually hit accounts. Who uses SNAP benefits to buy groceries in America? Roughly 42 million Americans do. That's about one in every eight of us, meaning we all know people who use food stamps, whether it's discussed or not. According to the latest available statistics from the USDA, 19% of SNAP recipients are considered elderly, ages 60 and older. 39% are children, and 42% are ages 18 to 59. 37% of recipients are white, 26% African American, 16% Hispanic, 4% Asian, 1% Native American. And the race of the remaining 17% was listed as unknown. More than 79% of households receiving SNAP benefits include a family member who is either a child, elderly, or has disabilities. 38% of SNAP participants come from working families drawing a paycheck. Most, or 73%, come from households whose gross monthly income is at or below the federal poverty level. For a family of four, that's roughly $32,000. This map shows the states which have populations with the highest percentage of SNAP recipients. A high percentage is in dark colors, the lowest in lighter colors. More than 16% of the populations of Oregon, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Louisiana are food stamp recipients. Eligibility for SNAP benefits is diverse and specific to each household, depending on a mix of income, assets, and work-related criteria for able-bodied people of a certain age. But all recipients meet low-income thresholds. Some recipients might be working full-time but for low wages, some part-time, some may be people who have become unemployed. Many are receiving other forms of public assistance like Social Security. Some might be homeless. With worry and concern over whether those millions of people will be able to buy food for their families in November, we take a look at the human toll of that uncertainty. As low-income Americans brace for what's next, thousands of paid staff and volunteers are stepping up to do what they can at food pantries, religious organizations, and other distribution centers set up to help the hungry. Roselle Regis reports.
Right now, times are tough for everybody. And it's going to get even harder because of the government shutdown. And they don't really seem to care.
Every other Saturday in the basement of Central Christian Church in downtown Indianapolis, this food pantry opens its doors to 45 to 50 households. This week, that number rose to more than 75, as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP benefits, are anticipated to lapse on November 1st. This is the latest blow to those already affected by the ongoing government shutdown and to low-income families struggling to make ends meet.
For me personally, I think I can absorb it because I'm one. But please, I've got to hearken back to the families, man. What do you think they're going to go through? You know?
In Indiana, nearly 600,000 people rely on SNAP to put food on the table. Soon, there is growing concern that food banks will not be able to provide food for everyone in need, as they are already stretched thin.
What we know about food insecurity in this country is that volunteer food pantries like ours and others cannot meet the need. SNAP is an essential piece of meeting the food need in the United States. And SNAP is being cut. It's very tragic. And so we are concerned about sustainability.
The same situation can be seen across the country. In Northwest Missouri, United Way of Greater St. Joseph hosted a Caring Connection event where volunteers assembled 300 meal kits for families. But they admit their efforts are not enough.
What we're doing today are some meal kits, and we recognize that that's just like a drop in a bucket. It's one dinner. It is not replacing the benefits, but we hope it's a little bit of stress relief.
United Way is working with several local organizations in the St. Joseph area to have more meal kit prep events in the future. Meanwhile, volunteers voiced that they have already seen the impact of SNAP benefits being restricted.
My main concern is for people who really can't work as much and who really need it and have like big families, maybe 3 to 5, mouths to feed, and you now have to come out of pocket for all those things you almost get assisted from. This is going to be a big scare.
Miles away in Michigan, residents lined up their cars at Woodside Bible Church to get much-needed food items. An estimated 1.4 million Michiganders could see their food assistance benefits cut off.
Please, please, we definitely need this. We definitely, definitely need it. And it's helping us out a lot. And it's, you know, for the kids to, you know, get off school, they have something to eat, you know, when they get home, you know, and this, we need this food.
Along with residents, Forgotten Harvest, Metro Detroit's leading food rescue nonprofit organization, is also feeling the pressure. Michigan food banks recently lost nearly 3 million pounds of food in canceled deliveries as $500 million was cut in funding for their Commodity Credit Corporation back in March. That program, which falls under the U.S. Department of Agriculture, provides food to food banks and other emergency food providers.
We'll lean on our supporters, whether it be our food donors or our financial donors. We're going to really have to lean into the community support that we need to be able to help us get through this difficult time for everybody.
In North Dakota, where 57,000 people are set to lose their SNAP benefits, the Great Plains Food Bank sent out a plea for donations, urging the public to help address the rise in food insecurity in the region.
To prepare for the possibility of SNAP pause, we are working with our local partners in all of the communities, shelters, soup kitchens, pantries.
Their goal is to distribute an additional 1 million pounds of food. The food bank is also considering starting mobile distribution routes and fundraising to ensure SNAP recipients still have access to food. In Maryland, food banks and soup kitchens are already seeing a spike in new clients.
We are seeing a lot of non-traditional clients in both to come to Beans and Bread throughout the year. So people who would never have even thought about utilizing a day resource and are now coming to receive food bag support or access to health care.
Beans and Bread, a resource center run by St. Vincent de Paul of Baltimore, provides meals and groceries to those in need.
Here at Beans and Bread, they usually serve about 200 meals a day. But since the shutdown, they've been seeing more and more people coming in.
Today has been crazy. Today has been, it's the very end of the month, and which is always busier, but today has been extremely busy. So I think it's already taking its toll, the shutdown and the lack of food.
According to their data, 1 in 8 people in Maryland and 1 in 4 in Baltimore City are food insecure.
So now that SNAP benefits are about to lose funding, do you anticipate more people wanting to get a bag soon?
Yes, we have geared up to get ready for November. Before, we would give maybe 2 bags a day. Now we're giving 8 to 12.
With 700,000 Marylanders expected to run out of SNAP benefits, Beans and Bread is currently asking for more donations and volunteers to brace for the impact. In a statement, Archbishop William Laurie of the Archdiocese of Baltimore said, government shutdowns have far-reaching consequences, but they have a particularly heavy toll on the most vulnerable among us. He stated, when vital government services are interrupted or delayed, the result is more than an inconvenience. It can mean hunger, anxiety, and hardship for our brothers and sisters in need. He reminded the people of Maryland that archdiocesan ministries remain open and active. He said, "Let us continue to be people of hope, united in prayer, steadfast in charity, and faithful in our care for the most vulnerable among us." Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
As the government shutdown grinds on and a potential loss of SNAP food benefits looms, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops went on the record this week with strong commentary. U.S. Bishops Conference President Archbishop Timothy Broglio wrote, "U.S. bishops are deeply alarmed that essential programs that support the common good, such as SNAP, may be interrupted. This would be catastrophic for families and individuals who rely on SNAP to put food on the table and places the burdens of the shutdown most heavily on the poor and vulnerable of our nation, who are the least able to move forward. This consequence is unjust and unacceptable." On behalf of the bishops, Broglio pleaded with lawmakers and the administration to work in a bipartisan way to quickly end the government shutdown and fund life-saving programs. For an inside look into how the expiration of federal food stamp funding is impacting the state, With one of the highest poverty rates, we turn to our first guest. Archbishop John Wester leads the Archdiocese of Santa Fe in New Mexico. New Mexico has the highest SNAP participation rate in the nation, with 21% of the population receiving SNAP benefits. Thank you so much for being with us. First, can you offer a quick reaction to this political moment we find ourselves in and the reality that federal funding for SNAP has expired amid this ongoing, now more than a month-long government shutdown?
Yes, Catherine, we're very anxious here in New Mexico and hoping that the shutdown will end soon. We realize that many people are going to be affected by this, and so we're praying hard. I know it's a complicated matter and a lot to it, but we're just praying hard that we can get the government back and running again soon.
Well, as I mentioned in your introduction, 21% of New Mexico's population receives SNAP benefits. That is approximately 460,000 New Mexicans, the highest participation rate in the nation. The state announced this week it will provide $30 million in state dollars to ensure that New Mexicans can continue receiving food benefits amid the shutdown. But Your Excellency, what specifically is the church in New Mexico doing to respond to this immediate need?
Well, first of all, I'd say that the church, the New Mexico Conference of Catholic Bishops, Bishop Baltacchino, Bishop Wall, and I, we've been advocating mainly through Alan Sanchez, who is our director of the Catholic Conference here, for the government to help in any way they can. And so we're quite pleased that they've come up with the $30 million for the first 2 weeks of November to help those who are on SNAP benefits. So that's one of the first things we've done. And secondly, we work hard in our own parishes, the St. Vincent de Paul Society, for example, food banks, Felix Pantry is one example, to have food banks where people can come and get food. And it's done in a very beautiful way, really respecting their dignity and helping them come and shop as they wish and then to leave with their groceries. So we've done a lot. And it kind of more in a long-term solution, we've had, as you probably know, Catherine, Alan runs the wonderful center that visits about over 600 families a week for families who have children in the womb to 3 years old. And they help them with health, nutrition, best practices. These good practices help people to come out of poverty and to live more productive lives. So we do all that we can to help them.
And I'd love to get into that more in just a moment. But just to stay on that point, with so many Americans who are reliant on food stamps, this week's news has renewed debate and discussion about better ways to lift up our brothers and sisters up out of poverty so they're not so dependent on the federal government for basic needs. Can you speak more about how the Catholic Church in New Mexico is helping to lead in this way to help to provide long-term solutions outside of the immediate food assistance that's needed this week?
Well, that's right. You know, the jobs are so important. Here in New Mexico, of course, we don't have a lot of the jobs that we might see, for example, in Nevada, Colorado, Utah, Arizona. So that is a problem. We have a very stubborn poverty here. We have violent crime and addiction. So these are things that the church tries to address as best we can. We work mainly by advocating for the poor with our state legislature. Our Catholic Conference works hard in that regard. I think that, you know, again, it's not easy. We ourselves just coming out of bankruptcy a few years ago, so we're struggling ourselves as an archdiocese. Mm-hmm. But we're very conscious of the need, and we do all that we can to help people in that regard. Mm.
According to the U.S. Census Bureau, New Mexico's child poverty rate was the highest among all states. In 2023, nearly one in four New Mexican children under the age of 18 years lived in poverty. That is a sobering statistic. Tell us more about the Catholic Parenting Partnership the Church in New Mexico offers and the difference that that helps to make in the state.
The Catholic Partnership?
Yes. Can you tell us more about Common Spirit St. Joseph's Children Program and the difference that that helps to make in the state?
Yes, the Common Spirit program that's run by Alan Sanchez there and his team is a marvelous program. It's really an ideal program. Mm-hmm. And it took a long time to set up, and it's been going for years and years. They visit about well over 600 families a week. Mm-hmm. They go to the families, and since the pandemic now, they've discovered they use Zoom a lot or some method of getting into the families digitally because they get easier access. People don't worry so much about having to clean the home or something before the visitor comes. But they give the families, the pregnant parents, best practices for the good health of their child. They help them with diet, nutrition, medicine, things of that nature, all free. It's all done free of charge. And not only that, but Alan has really spearheaded an effort by the Catholic Conference here in New Mexico to get a constitutional amendment, which we passed a few years ago. So we take 1.5% of that fund, the state fund, which is used to be the second, I believe now it's the highest fund in the country. And that money is used for the same purpose, to help children in from the womb to 3 years old. Our Alan's motto is a good one. He said, better put money in the playpen than the state pen. Wow. Help parents to know what to do, how to really raise their child in a healthy, wonderful way. And that's really, I think, in the long run, will help reduce poverty as well.
And in my final moment with you, we're having this discussion just 3 weeks after Pope Leo XIV released his first major papal document, De Lex Aeté, which is all centered on the topic of poverty. What can our Holy Father offer to American Catholics right now as we focus on caring for those who are impoverished?
Yes, I was really pleased by Pope Leo's apostolic exhortation. And what struck me was that he asks us not only to do for the poor, but to love the poor, that we don't just give them a handout, but that we truly love them and we work out of that love, that all of us in the presence of God, we're all poor. It's not like here you have the poor over here and we're over here. No, we're all poor in God's presence. We all need God's love, God's compassion, God's mercy. We're all vulnerable. And so we reach out to the poor out of love. And really, when we reach out to the poor, the Pope is telling us we're helping our own. We're helping our brothers and sisters in Christ.
Archbishop Wester, thank you so much for your time this week.
Thank you, Catherine. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
There is a way you can help Americans who rely on SNAP to feed their families. Catholic Charities USA has organized a fundraiser to help its local affiliates across the country provide meals for those who need them most. You can learn more and make a donation at ccusa.online/shutdown. And before we close this segment, an update to a news story that has often been connected to shutdown coverage because of the $40 billion U.S. dollars pledged to bail out the government of Argentina at the same time the U.S. government itself shut down 4 weeks ago. Last Sunday, President Javier Milei's party scored decisive victories in midterm elections with the backing of billions of dollars from the Trump administration to stop a free fall in the valuation of Argentina's currency. President Trump considers Milei a key ideological ally and publicly threatened to pull out U.S. funds to prop up Argentina's economy if voters in Argentina did not support him. Now, with victory in hand, the $40 billion bailout with U.S. taxpayer money continues. A wide-ranging spectrum of critics say that money could be used to help Americans here at home instead. The news continues when we return. A Catholic Army veteran shares his concerns about the Army's cancellation of religious service contracts, details about Pope Leo's upcoming digital appearance in the U.S., and this.
David, what you have done here never be forgotten.
And our interview with the lead actor of House of David, Michael Iskander, talks to us about the faith that inspires him to portray one of the most famous kings of all time.
A recent decision from the U.S. Army to cancel all support contracts for chapel services leaves Catholic chaplains without vital lay support and has sparked sharp criticism from the Archdiocese for the Military Services USA. Contracts for musicians, religious education coordinators, and administrators ended in early October. Other religious specialists will take their place, but Archbishop Timothy Broglio says they are not required to be Catholic and are not trained to be catechists. He also says soldiers cannot simply leave base for religious education because Many live in remote areas or non-Christian countries. Broglio has promised to pursue all legal options against what he calls a grave misstep, one that infringes on the free exercise of religion for Army Catholics and burdens chaplains already stretched thin. According to a 2021 report from the research group RAND, there is only one Catholic chaplain for every 1,000 Catholic soldiers. But there are six Protestant chaplains for every 1,000 Protestant soldiers. That means Catholic chaplains serve six times the number of soldiers than their Protestant counterparts serve. What are the wider repercussions of the U.S. Army's decision to cancel chapel support contracts? And how will it impact faith formation on base and in the homes of our very military families who are sacrificing for us? We explore that topic with our next guest. Will Tebow is a veteran of the Army's 75th Ranger Regiment, a devout Catholic, and serves as the director of the American Military Project at the Claremont Institute. Will, thank you so much for joining us for this important discussion. And I want to add even more context for our viewers here. A U.S. Army spokesperson told our sister news service Catholic News Agency it will reexamine its contract support to mitigate potential impact. But Archbishop Broglio, the Archdiocese for the Military Services USA, says that is not an adequate response. So, Will, first things first, as an Army veteran, as a devout Catholic, what is your reaction to this decision from the U.S. Army?
More so than anything, Catherine, I think I'm disappointed. The decision to cancel these contracts has a tangible effect on life for soldiers who are Catholic in the Army. And it's not an easy one to begin with. Imagine if you're a soldier, or even imagine you're a normal American, and you're told that you have to change your parish every 2 to 3 years. That's hard enough, given the demands of Army life. So I do think the Army, by its own mission, has an obligation to make the practice of faith, especially the Catholic faith, given how many soldiers are Catholic, as conducive and fruitful as possible. Without this critical support, it gets a lot harder because, as you also showed in the intro, Catholic priests are really hard to come by on military installations, and so they need all the support they can get. And that's okay to give them that support through government contracts.
And can you expand on that exact point, how this decision especially impacts Catholics and Catholic soldiers?
Of course. Again, one priest serves about 1,000 Catholic soldiers. That is beyond anything that, again, a civilian would experience in a Catholic diocese in America. You know, the response from the chaplain's corps in the Army was to have priests cover down on some of these services. But, you know, many of us know, many of your viewers know, that a priest already has a lot to do given the sacramental obligations of his ministry. To then ask him to plan the music liturgy, to plan religious education and sacramental preparation, that is a significant workload that, you know, bridges on the edge of impossible. And it is something that is uniquely a prospect for Catholics because of the sacramental nature of our faith. And so I do think there's a degree to which we need to, you know, evangelize our Protestant brothers and sisters in the Army and in the chaplain's corps who are making these decisions to know that these are not meaningless kind of conveniences, but essential people who support Catholic faith formation.
You wrote on this very topic for Word on Fire this week, and I want to pull up part of your article. You write, "This contract decision, compared to the scale of the persecution of Catholics in Nigeria and the widespread secularization of the West, is of modest importance. The decision does reveal, however, a troubling conception of faith in the public square taking hold, even in an era of politically muscular conservatism that should otherwise protect those of faith and public institutions." Can you expand on that? What are the wider implications of this decision from the U.S. Army?
Right. Well, you know, I first wanted to give an acknowledgement that there, Christians, Catholics especially, face horrid persecution around the world. And so it's not meant to, you know, try and position Catholics in the Army on that same playing field. But it is to showcase that the decision of the Army to cancel these contracts reveals a troubling reality about how they understand religious freedom. And this was even true on public comments on X, where they questioned how the cancellation of these contracts would inhibit a Catholic soldier from freely expressing his faith in uniform. But that is an inherently negative perception mm-hmm. of religious freedom. And in reality, the chaplain's mission for the U.S. Army is to make soldiers as spiritually ready as possible mm-hmm. for war. And that, frankly, from personal experience, requires a lot of spiritual fitness and spiritual readiness to be able to do the mission of which the country asks us. And so it's not merely about not getting in the way, mm-hmm. but it is about an obligation to make the practice of the Catholic faith possible and flourishing on Army installations, and for families who give so much of their lives to the nation through the service member, in their family.
That being said, what is your message to the U.S. Army and the administration on this?
My message, Catherine, is to not let this be the place where we cut costs. Hmm. You cannot measure, perhaps, the value of these contracts in a return on investment or in a financial table that shows up neatly on the comptroller's spreadsheets. But you can be confident that Catholic families who earnestly want to serve in the Army for decades, that they will use these services, that they will need these men and women who want to serve as contractors to support the Chaplain's Corps, because it is about retention for the military. It's about a devout Catholic in uniform understanding that service in the Army is a place where he can lead his family to mm-hmm. also a vibrant mm-hmm. faith life, can lead his family to sainthood. Mm-hmm. If soldiers, Catholic soldiers, start to question if that's possible, I think they might leave at increasing rates. And I don't think this administration, I don't think our Army wants to find out mm-hmm. if that's true. Mm-hmm. I think we should give them everything they need so they don't have to make that hard choice.
Well, on that note, Will Tebow, thank you so much for your service, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Catherine.
We'll be right back.
The Pope is very happy. He wants to have an encounter with the young people.
Next, we talk to Cardinal Christophe Pierre, the Apostolic Nuncio to the United States, about a big event coming up in November, featuring a live interactive encounter between Pope Leo and American young people. A preview of the National Catholic Youth Conference after this.
We are less than a month away from Pope Leo XIV's first ever digital visit with American youth, marking the first time in history a pope will directly engage with U.S. youth in a live digital encounter. It will take place at the annual National Catholic Youth Conference, where teens from across the country gather to encounter Christ. The conference, organized by the National Federation for Catholic Youth Ministry, will draw nearly 15,000 young people for talks, fellowship, Mass, and Eucharistic adoration. This year's gathering will take place in Indianapolis at Lucas Oil Stadium, the same location as the National Eucharistic Congress last year. Pope Leo XIV will virtually join the teens for a live Q&A discussion, the first of his pontificate. The conference's leadership says the digital encounter shows the Holy Father's willingness to journey with young people.
But I think by him joining virtually, he's also communicating that I'm going to meet you where you're at. This is a platform where I know you're already there, so let's continue the conversation even beyond the one-time experience.
And to have the Holy Father, the Vicar of Christ, take the time to be with them and to walk with them in that moment is an expression of his solidarity and is an expression of his love, which I think these young people will never, ever forget.
Ahead of this historic event for both the U.S. Church and for young people, I sat down recently with Pope Leo's own representative here in the U.S., Cardinal Christophe Pierre, the Apostolic Nuncio to the United States. His Eminence shared more insight and behind the scenes for how this upcoming digital encounter came to be. Cardinal Christophe Pierre, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Very happy to be with you.
Your Eminence, this encounter is being described as the first digital visit with the youth of America with the Holy Father. Do you have any insight as to why he desired to do this?
I think the Pope wants to address the young people. And the digital way of communicating is the way that the young are communicating. So I think, as a church, we should not be afraid of using this even if we are not necessarily professional in that. But at least the Pope is very happy. He wants to have an encounter with the young people.
Mm. And I understand it was Pope Leo himself who wanted this to be more of a dialogue event with young people.
Yes, exactly.
Why was that important to him?
Well, I think the only way of, especially with the young people, is that's also personal in my own experience. Mm-hmm. I think we need really to help people to ask questions instead of giving straightforward answers.
Mm.
I think the process of education, especially today, is to help people to mature questions. Mm. And the only way to do that is through dialogue. And, imagine the Holy Father will have a dialogue with 15,000 young men and women, mm-hmm. From 16 or 14 to 18, mm-hmm. but millions. Through them, millions all over the world. Mm-hmm. But I am convinced that, and this is my personal experience, that, we have a tendency to give straightforward answers,
yeah.
But help the people to raise questions to themselves. Mm-hmm. And so we go too fast. And I think the Holy Father wants to be there with them, to accompany them.
Mm. What does it reveal that Pope Leo XIV is prioritizing this digital encounter with youth so early in his pontificate?
Well, I think he should not waste time.
Mm.
And I think, actually, he has been doing a lot, over the last few weeks and even mm-hmm. months now mm-hmm. since he has been elected. And I would say his work is precisely to communicate. And communicate at all level. But I am very happy that he has chosen, actually, the United States, to mm-hmm. to have this kind of first, global encounter using such a method,
Absolutely.
So it's like a try, we will try. We will see if it works or not.
Yes.
I hope it will.
And readjust throughout the rest
exactly,
of his pontificate. Does a digital encounter with the U.S. mean that a physical papal visit will now be delayed? Many American Catholics are excited to see their first U.S.-born pope here in the U.S. and are wondering if he'll be here for the 250th anniversary of our country.
This I cannot answer.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we all, I am sure that the Pope desires, to have an encounter with the Americans,
mm-hmm.
and he being himself an American. But, it's too early to say that. I am French, and I know that already that a lot of people are speaking about the possibility for the Pope to go to France. So, all over the place, it will be like that.
Right. Many people are waiting for that. Cardinal Christophe Pierre, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Pope Leo's digital encounter with young people at the National Catholic Youth Conference will be on Friday, November 21st at 10:15 a.m. Eastern. The Q&A with our Holy Father will exclusively be broadcast and live streamed on EWTN. And be sure to stay tuned to EWTN for extended coverage of the conference from November 20th through 22nd. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Israel this week bombarded Gaza once again with deadly fire in what many are calling the most serious challenge yet to President Donald Trump's 20-point peace plan. Those airstrikes top headlines in the Week in Review. The ceasefire appeared to be back on track hours after it was derailed, showing just how fragile the truce is. There was chaos across Gaza as explosions rang out Tuesday night. Palestinian authorities say more than 100 people were killed, making it the deadliest attack in the enclave since the ceasefire began. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered the attack after Palestinian gunmen fired on Israeli soldiers in southern Gaza. Hamas denies any part in the attack and says Israel's strikes violate the truce. This is not the first exchange of blame and fire since Trump's peace plan went into effect 3 weeks ago, but the president expressed confidence the ceasefire will continue while defending Israel's strikes.
Nothing's going to jeopardize. You have to understand, Hamas is a very small part of peace in the Middle East, and they have to behave. They're on the rough side, but they said they would be good, and if they're good, they're going to be happy, and if they're not good, they're going to be terminated. Their lives will be terminated.
Questions remain about who will govern the war-torn enclave and if Hamas will disarm. The militant group has already reasserted control in parts of Gaza no longer occupied by Israel. Hamas faced further condemnation from Israel this week for continued failure to return the bodies of the remaining deceased hostages. Two bodies were returned to their families on Thursday. On Monday, Hamas delivered a coffin, but Israel confirmed it contained the remains of a hostage whose body was already partially recovered nearly 2 years ago. Further controversy on Tuesday when Israel released drone video reportedly showing Hamas militants staging the discovery of a buried body in front of the Red Cross. Hamas claims it has already returned all the bodies it can access in the rubble that is Gaza. Netanyahu vowed Israel will not relent until it brings everyone home. Devastation at a hospital in western Sudan after the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces seized the capital of the Darfur region last weekend. Satellite images show signs of a massacre outside the hospital where paramilitants kidnapped six health workers and killed nearly 500 patients and visitors at a maternity hospital in El Fasher, the last functioning hospital in the war-torn city. Sudan's military says some 2,000 people have been murdered in the wake of the city's capture. Human rights groups warn ethnically motivated killings will likely increase. President Donald Trump has agreed to reduce tariffs on China after holding a meeting with President Xi Jinping, his first summit with his Chinese counterpart in more than 6 years. Their meeting concluded Trump's packed six-day trip through East Asia. Trump's stops included Malaysia and Japan, but the trip's highlight came on Thursday in Busan, South Korea, when Trump met Xi on the sidelines of the APEC summit. The two leaders agreed to extend a tariff truce struck earlier this year. Trump will reduce tariffs by 10% on Chinese goods in exchange for China's promise to crack down on fentanyl. China will once again buy U.S. soybeans and roll back on strict new limits on the sales of rare earth minerals, a crucial element for AI and technology. The deal shows thawing relations between the world's largest economies, but foreign policy experts say Xi came out with the upper hand.
It is good that we have de-escalated the situation with China, but the president really escalated to de-escalate to get back to where we started. As an analyst said this morning, he's all about tactics more than he is about strategy. And he uses tariffs to try to create leverage. But in fact, Xi, as Nick Kristof of the New York Times has said, really holds the critical leverage.
Right before his meeting with Xi, Trump announced on his Truth Social that he ordered the U.S. military to restart testing nuclear weapons after 33 years. He did not specify what weapons or where in the U.S. they would be tested. The move seemed to be a message to both China and Russia, but experts worry the move could escalate tension and encourage other countries to test their nuclear weapons as well. This week, the Defense Department continued to carry out lethal strikes on small boats off South America it claims are narco-trafficking drug vessels. The strikes on Tuesday and Wednesday sank five boats in the Eastern Pacific and claimed the lives of 18 people. More than 60 people the Trump administration calls narco-terrorists have been killed since the beginning of these attacks in early September. On Capitol Hill, members of both parties continue to question the legality of the strikes and whether the president has the constitutional power to authorize them. In the meantime, in a show of force, the Defense Department is repositioning its newest and most technologically advanced aircraft carrier from the Adriatic Sea in Europe to the South American coast. In a statement, the Pentagon said the USS Gerald Ford and the other vessels in its strike group will bolster U.S. ability to detect, monitor, and disrupt activities off South America that compromise the safety of the United States. One of the most powerful Atlantic storms in more than a century and a half hit the Caribbean this week, leaving a trail of devastation in its path. Hurricane Melissa slammed into Jamaica as a Category 5 storm on Tuesday, with winds raging at 185 miles per hour. It then struck Cuba, the Bahamas, and Haiti, destroying homes and leaving whole neighborhoods underwater or without power. In Jamaica, entire neighborhoods were washed away. Nearly 50 people have died, a majority of them in Haiti. It could take weeks to understand the scope of Melissa's damage. The U.S. military will step in to support disaster relief efforts on the islands. A sign of the economic times and the advance of artificial intelligence. The second largest private employer in the U.S., Amazon, is poised to lay off roughly 30,000 employees. The first round of layoffs began on Tuesday when the e-commerce giant slashed 14,000 corporate jobs in human resources, marketing, engineering, and media and communications. The company says it wants to stay, quote, nimble, as it anticipates artificial intelligence productivity gains. So far, those AI gains and employment cuts are not impacting frontline warehouse positions. Amazon is not immune to other business pressures like the cost of absorbing tariffs and an uncertain business climate. But analysts say a reduction in headcount is also the result of AI advances and a desire to increase profits.
All owners of companies are being driven because of this AI technology and the ability to automate so many standard processes. A lot of investors want higher gross margins. They want higher net margins. And this is largely part of Amazon's path towards higher margins. They've been in high growth mode for more than 30 years. They're looking to harvest some of those investments that they have made. And automation is one of the ways that they're going to do that.
During a quarterly earnings call on Thursday, Amazon's CEO said the company had grown too big and extra layers of management had slowed decision making. He said Amazon needed to be more lean and fast moving while it trimmed headcount and diverted more money toward investment in AI. Pope Leo writes on AI's use in Catholic education in the second major document of his pontificate. His letter honors the 60th anniversary of the Second Vatican Council's Declaration on Christian Education. Pope Leo signed the letter titled Drawing New Maps of Hope on Monday, ahead of its Tuesday release. In this document, the Holy Father emphasizes the importance of forming a student's head and heart. He argues Catholic education must help students develop an interior life through silence and prayer and learn how to use technology and AI wisely. Leo emphasizes that technology must serve the person, not replace them. He writes, "No algorithm can replace what makes education human. Poetry, irony, love, art, imagination, the joy of discovery, and even education in error as an opportunity for growth. The decisive point is not technology, but the use we make of it." In that letter, Pope Leo declared St. John Henry Newman co-patron of Catholic education along with St. Thomas Aquinas. He is officially declaring the English cardinal a doctor of the church on Saturday, the Solemnity of All Saints, and the final day of the Jubilee of the World of Education. If your university had a Catholic student center, it might have been named after this soon-to-be doctor. Newman was a renowned 19th century Anglican priest who taught at Oxford. After converting to the Catholic faith, he helped found the Catholic University of Ireland and later the Oratory School in Birmingham. His writings and contributions to Catholic education became so well known that Catholic student clubs across the U.S. began to be called Newman Centers after his death. Newman joins 37 other doctors of the church recognized for their contributions to theology and doctrine. Next, our interview with the star of the hit series, House of David.
It's not about me, it's about him. I need to follow him and I need to listen to his commandments and I need to put myself aside.
After Michael Iskander's inside look at the making of the epic story of King David.
I will tell you the story of David, a simple shepherd boy.
Why do my brothers get to fight? And I'm stuck here.
David, you are not a man of blood.
An outcast who became one of the most famous kings who ever lived.
The story of King David made into a biblical drama called House of David is a huge hit, having reached the number one spot on Prime Video in the U.S. and garnering more than 40 million views worldwide. Michael Iskander is the lead actor who portrays King David. Born in Egypt and raised as an Orthodox Coptic Christian, Iskander is a recent, enthusiastic, and very committed convert to Catholicism. He spoke recently with our Catholic news agency colleague Francesca Fenton about the highly anticipated second season of House of David and his faith journey that inspires his acting.
He sees into the heart. And you, have the heart of a lion.
I really, really love this season. I think I'm extremely proud of it and proud of the work that we've done this time, because it is truly a transformative season. And the time of David, people asked, how is this guy going to defeat Goliath? He's just a youth. He's just, you know, blah, 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 blah. He's a shepherd.
David. You have done here. Will never be forgotten.
You know, in the same way, this time around in this season, people are questioning, how is this guy going to be a commander? Mm-hmm. How is he going to lead Saul's armies? But we see that transformation that God takes him on. We see that complete switch in demeanor, complete switch in confidence in his build. He's a different man by the end of the season than he is at the beginning. And it's really indicative of how much God can work in our lives if we let him. So this season for me is a season of transformation. It's a season of war. A lot of blood is shed this time. But it's also, everything is just bigger. There's romance, there's drama, there's a lot of fighting. You know, it's just, it's super, super fun. And there's so much more biblical material that I think is going to be really informative for people. We really dive into the friendship between David and Jonathan this season. Mm-hmm. And that friendship is, it's one of the only kind of main friendships that we see in the Old Testament between two guys. And it's really a model for us as men today of how do we express love for one another? Mm. How do we show friendship? What is true friendship? What does love and friendship look like?
So how has your faith been impacted by portraying David?
I mean, it's been, in every way it's been impacted. I think one of the biggest things that has affected me is learning about why God chose David and why he rejected Saul. And ultimately, Saul was a prideful king. And in the beginning, it says he was humble, but you look at his history, his beginning, his anointing as a king, and really you see not humility, but you see low self-confidence.
I'm the chosen. God favored me. He always has.
And as the attention and the love started to become on him, this low self-confidence became ego, covering for this low self-esteem. So it makes sense that he became prideful. But rather, David did not have self-confidence. He was humble. And humility is not about, you know, bowing down to others. No, humility is about seeing the true value of something and understanding truth. Humility is truth. And so as David, God chose David because of his humble heart. And a humble heart is a heart that's willing to follow God. It's a heart that's willing to listen to him and do as he commands, versus a prideful heart is going to choose my wants, my needs, my selfish desires over him. A selfish heart is going to place yourself even with God, which is what happened with Saul, ultimately why he was rejected.
God, give me this ground. Every step, just one step.
I ask for a champion. You come against me with a stick, you will become the victim of my wrath.
But God says, I will choose a man after my own heart. I will choose a man who does what I tell him. And that kind of clicked something in my brain. It's like, no, God chose David because David loved God, and thus David was going to follow God's commandments. He was going to do God's will on earth. And so it really, once that clicked, I was like, oh, it's not about me, it's about him. I need to follow him, and I need to listen to his commandments, and I need to put myself aside. I need to not think about myself. And really, it's freeing. It's a freeing thing to just, you know, put yourself aside and live for Christ. Because who wouldn't want to do that? Actually, a lot of people wouldn't want to do that. But it's for me, I think that's the most beautiful thing, to put ourselves aside and to live for him.
What do you hope people are taking away from this show?
I think I really hope people take away the point of the story, which is that everything about David, to go back to what I said earlier, is about the heart. What does your heart look like?
From this day forward, you will join the house of Saul.
Are you ready to be a commander of men?
I hope people ponder this question. Do we love God? Do we love him as much as we should? Christ says to lay one's life for another, that is the greatest love we can show. Are we willing to lay down our lives for Christ? In the same manner that David did. David was put in so many life-threatening situations because of God. God let him through. Are we willing to trust him to lead us through those same challenges? And ultimately, above this, do we love God? That is the most important question. So I hope people ask themselves that question. And I hope it inspires them to go on a deeper faith journey. And for me, I ultimately hope it inspires them to grow closer to Christ.
The second season of House of David is currently airing exclusively on Prime Video through a Wonder Project subscription. You can watch our full interview with Michael Iskander on our EWTN News YouTube channel. And finally, with Friday being All Hallows Eve, costumes ranging from the comic to the creative are on full display. Many Catholic families are opting to honor the communion of the saints with their costumes, imitating holy men and women as we honor All Saints this weekend. If your little ones will be dressing in saint costumes, we would love to spotlight their divinely inspired dress right here on our show. You can send photos of your families and children's saint costumes to our email address, video@ewtnnews.com. Or you can send us your little saints on X and Instagram by messaging us at EWTN News In Depth. Your little Therese or Maximilian Kolbe might just be featured on our program next week. And that's it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Catherine Hadrow. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.